Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. I'd like to welcome you to my program and also to WVW-TV. We're happy to be able to bring this program and many other programs to you without a paywall and without a subscription. That's a real blessing that we have here because we can bring our viewpoints to the marketplace of ideas without the burden of having to charge. And we do that, of course, through kind viewer donations like perhaps you. And when you donate to the foundation, you're certainly helping WVW-TV stay on the air and bringing this type of information and this type of programming. WVW has been around since 2006, and we're a recognized voice in the great marketplace of ideas. And we do appreciate you watching us and taking advantage of what we have to offer and also kindly supporting our efforts and our operation. As you know, we're a sponsored network. We're not commercial network. We don't run commercials and interrupt, but we do have sponsors that sponsor our programming. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, my sponsor, Swiss America Trading, which is a great fine purveyor of precious metals based out of Arizona. It's an American company, and they make a market in tangible precious metals, which is fancy language for gold and silver coins and bullion and numismatic collection coins. So if you're thinking of adding that type of product to your individual portfolio, you might want to give them a call at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them for some free investor information. They're happy to mail it out to you. And you can go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, use the promo code Eastman for Eastman Financial Report, and then they will know that to send out free information to you as well. So if you're interested in adding gold or silver or platinum coins to your tangible holdings, and you're looking for someone, a good vendor, somebody who's been in the space a long time with a solid reputation, give them a call because they're more than happy to help you out and answer your questions. Let's jump into the news for today. And it's, you know, this is sort of an ongoing saga. We know where we are within this snapshot of time in our economic analysis. And of course, we've just seen over the weekend, I talked about this most of the day yesterday, or most of the program, that Congress has passed a continuing resolution that allows the government to continue to spend money until November 17th, which is just before Thanksgiving, and we'll go through the same dance again in mid-November. But I'm not going to repeat yesterday's show, but it was quite a process of watching the federal government limping forward and trying to remain in business. And it's, you know, certainly something that if you're concerned about, and you should be as an American citizen, you perhaps should call your elected representative and ask them for a little more fiscal prudence. But I'll leave that up to you. I did notice some interesting stories that are in the news today. And I wanted to talk about this very strange dynamic that's in the labor market. And let's take a little bit of time today to dissect what that's all about, because the labor numbers are very, very important to people who manage money and people who basically do budgets and people who do projections, because the idea is, and if you remember my model of national income, there's the earnings by private business and individuals' wages are the national income. It's all the money that the private sector generates, and that's the size of any economy. It's not the government, because remember, the government only derives its revenue theoretically by taxing the businesses and individuals. And the idea is that you will tax the businesses and individuals in your free market economy, and then you'll do public good things with them. You'll build highways and bridges and perhaps dams and clean water facilities and sewage waste processing plants. And you'll have a police department and an army, and maybe you'll deliver the mail. All of those public goods, and well, they're actually public services and public goods like highways and airports. You know, somebody has to build the airport. It's not the airlines. They don't build the airports. They use public infrastructure. But the point is, you have this free economy that exists. And whether you're in a socialist system or a capitalist system, it really doesn't matter, because the economy is businesses and individuals who earn money and spend money. And that's what businesses do. They take in revenues and they pay their bills, and there's profits, and the profits are distributed to shareholders, and the shareholders spend the money. And it's just one big circle of private enterprise. And it's global. The Chinese have this. course, they have a command central type economy with a, you know, the Communist Party, and it's trying to regulate all of this. But the reality is, if the Communist Party were to suddenly vanish into thin air, the Chinese economy would do just fine, because they've been at it for 6,000 years. They're very good at it. And I'm sure that just like ask the Soviet Union, you know, that was 70 years of trying to screw up the Russian economy, and the Russian economy is humming along just fine. So the point is, when you have this interaction, where you have a government that steps in and taxes and then spends it on public good, that is the part we fight about. Because the people who have ideas and dreams of a public greatness, big roads, big highways, big buildings, they don't have the money to do that. The money's over here. And the question is, how do you get the money out of that economy and put it into this public goods sector, which is somebody's vision? Let's have a food stamp program, or let's have free highways, or let's build a building or a bridge or a dam. And that's the interaction and dynamic that is the way this is supposed to work. And in happy economies, you have a government that's sort of the servant of the people. And that, of course, is the is how like a municipal government works. They tax the property owners. Maybe they have a sales tax. And then that's the money, and then they spend on police and fire. Up here, they plow the roads. I don't know, down south, they must sweep the roads. I don't know what they do. But the point is that those are the public goods, and it's always a direct relationship with the amount of money in the private economy. And that's a big part of how our economic scheme works. Well, I want to talk about the labor component to that, because that lives inside of this big private economy. And those numbers are very important, because what we look at is employment rates. And what we would like to envision in a utopian world, or maybe an Adam Smith type of a long-term economic equilibrium world, is that there's an economy and everybody who wants a job has a job, and everybody, I suppose, if they have a job, are making all the money they would like, and everybody's happy. Well, that's never the case, okay? Everybody wants to make more money and work less. You work less for more money. You know, that's why some people go into like computer coding, and some people go into automobile manufacturing. You know, it's a different thing. You know, so it's less effort to code, but the point is, labor is a very important component of that, and that's why we look at labor numbers. And of course, we have the Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, puts out numbers on a monthly and quarterly and annual basis that sort of blips out a signal to all the participants in the economy as to how the markets are doing, the labor market is doing. Do all people have jobs that want jobs? And there's always somebody who's transitional. You may be ill, you may be perhaps on maternity leave, you might be, might have gone back to school. So people go into the labor market, and then there are good reasons why they step out of the labor market and do whatever it is they're doing, and then perhaps rejoin the labor market. That's all the normal ebb and flow of life, and that's to be expected. So economists looking historically at labor statistic numbers will tell you that it's probably a 3% plus or minus natural unemployment, where in any given snapshot in time, 2.8, 3.2, somewhere in there, there's going to be people that are just, they're not in the workforce. They're just, for whatever good reason, they're not in the workforce. Then you have on top of that, that's called structural unemployment. Then on top of that, you have the involuntary people who really would like a job. They like a paycheck, they can pay their bills, but for whatever reason can't find a job. They may be mistrained, or they're trained in one thing and there's no job openings, and you know the jobs that they're not trained for is, you know, they're open plentiful, but there's a training differential. And that's sometimes why people go to college or back to school to get the training so they can take the new job in the new sector, and then they become structurally unemployed. But if they're wandering the streets looking for work, you know, we'll work for food. Basically, that's the unemployment rate that becomes very politically troubling, because those are the people who you could perceive as being unhappy, or I don't want to say angry, but they're unhappy, okay? And when people are unhappy, they tend to vote for somebody else. Whoever the incumbent is, you don't want a big pile of unhappies, because they won't vote for you, because they're going to blame you, because you know the buck stops on your desk and I'm unemployed, therefore I'm voting for the other guy. Well, that's why unemployment numbers become a really important political signal as to how our democracy is functioning. And that's why when we look at these unemployment numbers, you know, a lot of people have built their careers looking at unemployment numbers. And what we see is a lot of confusing and conflicting data within that sector. That's what I'm trying to bring up here and get to the point, is that unemployment claims came out and they were remarkably odd in that the number of job openings reported by the Department of Labor exploded to 9.6 million job openings. There's 9.6 million jobs out there and nobody to work in those jobs. It was 8.8 million like last month. And so the question is, how do you gain almost a million job openings at a time when unemployment rates tend to be relatively low? And yet at the same time, we have all of these, you know, people are pouring across the border and they're all sleeping in sleeping bags out in front of the buildings downtown. There seems to be a real disconnect between the ability to find American workers that will take these jobs, and this is assuming this number is correct. Keep in mind that these numbers are consistently revised downward. And if you are an incumbent running for re-election, you want to say the American economy is booming, it's healthy, it's never been better. You got 9.6 million jobs just looking for workers. Life is good. Then the question becomes, if you have 3.2% unemployment or 3.5 or whatever, pick a number over the last couple of months, then you have this gap that is illogical. And then the reason I say it's illogical is because there's also a story out there today that talks about the quit rate. And what the quit rate is sort of a new calculation. They're always looking for different ratios and different quotients or formulas to use to project the health or the stability or the soundness of the economy. And the quit rate is basically when people who have jobs and are unhappy will quit to get a better job. And it's not uncommon that about 3%, 4%, maybe 5%, the better the economy's doing, the higher the quit rate. Because when the economy's blasting along and you see, you know, that job's open and it pays 40% more than I'm making, you quit your job and you take that job and you better yourself, you better your economic position. Well, the story is that the quit rate has dropped from 3% to 2.3%, which was 3% in April, and now it's 2.3%. And what it shows is that people who have jobs are not leaving them. And it means that they're not leaving them because they don't want to quit their job and become unemployed and then start wandering looking for a new job, which is very hard on your personal budget. But what they're doing is they're holding onto their job like a security blanket. You know, times are tough. The jobs aren't out there. I'm not seeing another great opportunity to jump, so I'm going to hold. So only 2.3% of people on average, it's always an on average kind of thing, are making the leap. So then the question becomes, if all these new jobs have appeared, 9.6 million jobs are available for the taking, they're obviously not the kind of jobs that the people who already have jobs want, or they would quit their job and take one of these new jobs. Because if you think about the supply of labor, which is our population base, and the demand for labor, which is this private sector economy over here, it's all the businesses, well, I guess governments and schools as well, but there's a big demand for workers and labor. There's a gap of 9.6 million more jobs than there are people who want them. And then at the same time, we're seeing a number that says people who have jobs are becoming concerned and they're cautious and they're not quitting their jobs to hope there's another job down the road. And those numbers, that data seems to be very inconsistent when you're trying to analyze exactly what is the state of the American economy. And that's why I'm highly skeptical when the Department of Labor comes out with this crazy number that says 9.6 million jobs are just waiting to be filled. And I'm thinking, you know, if that were the case, because 9.6 million jobs is a lot of jobs in a gross population of 330 million, and the number of people working is probably in 150 to 180 million, and then you got 9 million, so that's like 5%. You know, that's just kind of a big number that is more than just transitional. So I guess the question becomes, where is market equilibrium? This is the Adam Smith in the long run, we're all in equilibrium. Where are we in that point in the United States right now today, in this snapshot of today, where are we? Do we have 9.6 million jobs waiting to be filled? Well, wouldn't that be a great argument? We've got all these millions of people pouring over the border, and they're all sleeping in sleeping bags in front of the Neiman Marcus downtown somewhere. You know, it suggests that if you create this 9.6 million job number, and you have all these people basically here but nothing to do, then there's an argument to be made for, why don't we take all these immigrants and put them to work? And of course, the problem is that you have to like fill out forms, you have to apply, you have to be investigated, you have to be admitted as an immigrant. You can't just blow across the border and show up, hey, I'll take one of those 9.6. So my point is this a political thing to cover for the fact that we have this situation in America where all these people are just piling in from all over the globe? And, you know, frankly, it's an interesting phenomenon. I'm sure, you know, there's some real nasties that are slipping across the border. But you can imagine that there are people who see a golden opportunity to get in while the getting's good. And the question becomes, is this job number a wallpaper or, you know, some sort of a screen to justify this immigration policy or not? Because if you really had what is approaching 10 million jobs in the economy, you need to have an equilibrium balance. The number of workers, that's the supply of workers of, you know, all backgrounds, and the number of jobs, all jobs from, you know, the radiologist all the way down to, you know, whatever. There's a supply and there's a demand and there's an equilibrium at a certain quantity of workers, which is full employment, at a certain average wage, or at least a, you know, a plug number wage. That would be a market in equilibrium. So if you've got millions of people streaming into an economy that's already in labor equilibrium, what happens is you displace the lower end workers, you know, with the recent immigrants that will work for even lower money. And that is a known phenomenon in the United States. I mean, it's quite a phenomenon in many markets where you can get people who are, you know, here to do labor for you a lot cheaper than you can, you know, hire people who've been here for a while. Okay. So the point is, in a labor economics or equilibrium situation, we don't know where the equilibrium is. And that's why when you see these numbers, because if you're a casual reader of headlines, you think, boy, you know, job openings are up to 9.6. Economy must be doing great. Well, what if they revise it? And we know from, you know, every last time the government's put numbers out in 2023, they revise them down. They get the sizzle of the headline, and then, you know, later on they fix them, because in the history books, you don't want to look that crazy. Plus, you may have to justify it. So we shall see with labor. But I'm thinking to myself that this is one of the ways, you know, the administration could be trying to justify this flood of immigrants by basically saying, we got 9.6 million openings and we got all these people sleeping on the streets. Why don't we put them to work? We'll watch that and see. I'm not advocating illegal immigration. I mean, my ancestors, they filled out the paperwork, they stood in line, and that's the way an orderly, organized society should operate. And if the federal government feels that there are 9.6 million jobs and there are simply no Americans, we're all working two jobs and nobody can possibly fit in a third, then perhaps that's when you do decide to have some immigration policy that would attract workers to the country, that would basically fill that gap and grow the economy and make it a good place for everybody. And that's a different thing than just throwing open the borders and saying, we don't need any rules, and people just come piling in. It's a real problem. So we'll see. I think there's a lot of politics going on. And unfortunately, it's like I was talking about yesterday, the federal government is a real disappointment. When you look at how we run our 50 states and, you know, we've got our goods and our bads and this and that. But at the end of the day, we have to begin to expect more from the federal government. Responsibility, fiscal prudence. This isn't, you know, Santa Claus on steroids where they just spend money on every last whim and wish. And at the end of the day, you know, first you say, well, the taxpayers can't afford it. We're way past that. Okay, I want to dispel that illusion. Like, you hear that in Congress, you know, American taxpayer. Let me tell you, we are so far past that link between federal spending and the tax base of the United States. If the Congress taxed the people to fund whatever it is they're spending on, there wouldn't be any money left in the private sector. There wouldn't be. Then they might as well just, you know, it would. There isn't enough. So if you want to worry about the American taxpayer, maybe you ought to bring the system back into alignment so that the American taxpayer actually feels the pain of federal spending. And then they'll say, you know what, maybe I'm going to send the Republican or the cheapskate or the, you know, send the Libertarian or somebody. They don't spend any money. That we don't have that pricing signal in the American economy. We have a federal government that's just, you know, doing crazy things with money that doesn't exist. And that's the beauty of this, you know, this continuing resolution. Everybody, oh, good, now they fixed it. No, they didn't. They just merely extended the problem to November 17th. And here's poor Janet Yellen, Secretary Yellen. She's out there selling bonds like crazy to pay for all this stuff. And at the end of the day, the American taxpayer, less than half of them, well, I'd say about half of Americans don't pay federal taxes, or at least federal income tax. They don't have to. They don't make enough money. So for them, there's no pain. There's no 35% of your paycheck disappearing. They don't have a paycheck. You know, what do they care? This is just all Santa Claus, all free money. And at the end of the day, this becomes a real disconnect that ends in folly. There is no example in history where a mighty empire, a global empire, can print, spend, detach the spending from the tax base, and not just sail off the end of the earth. And it's just what happens. So, you know, it's a sad situation. And, you know, there's proof for that. It's not just me talking about it. I looked at the numbers today for the 30-year treasuries, and this is an interesting number. The 30-year treasuries, this is Secretary Janet Yellen, her job. She's got, when you're the treasurer of the United States, it's your job to collect the taxes, and then you've got to fund the agencies, because the agencies theoretically would have a budget, but they don't. They don't have a budget. They have continuing resolutions to spend. Her job, and I don't envy her. I mean, this is a big job, and she's highly experienced in this space. I'm not criticizing her performance. As a matter of fact, I kind of feel sorry for her. But her job is to make sure that all these agency buckets are full, so when they write those checks go out and they don't bounce. And the way she does that, because if you think about how our tax system works, we have an April 15th. Everybody knows that's the happy day. That's April 15th is tax day, and all the money comes pouring in, you know, but actually our withholding taxes come every 2 weeks or every week from your paycheck, and businesses and self-employed will file quarterly. And so there's this amount of tax dollars coming in, and it's little. And then there's this federal budget, which is big. So poor old Janet, she's got to go out and sell bonds. And that's what the federal treasury does. And they have certain bond houses that's what they do. They basically are the primary bond houses that, you know, Janet, hey, I need another $40 billion. Let's sell $40 billion into the market. And of course, the market keeps absorbing these bonds and absorbing the bonds. But the story is the market is sensing problems. And what's happened with the 30-year treasuries, they are now selling with an interest rate of 4.86%. It's actually 4.856, but we'll just say 4.8%. Okay, let's just use that. Keep the numbers simple. That's higher than it's been in a very, very long time. It's higher than it's been since 2007. And the year 2007 into 2008 was the big financial crisis where the whole banking system was teetering and Lehman Brothers went broke and Bear Stearns got gobbled up and it was a crisis. So what this is telling us today is that because of this rampant federal spending, and I'm seeing projections of up to $2 trillion deficit in this fiscal year. Well, we're at $33 trillion. That's going to add to 4-5. If you go back and watch my reruns, I was saying 35, 36. You know, I'm not a soothsayer or a fortune teller. I can just count. Okay, I got 10. I can count to 10. Okay, I'm pretty good at it. And when you add 2 to 33, it becomes 35. Okay. Well, the point is that not since 2007 have we seen interest rates at 4.8%+. And what it's doing is it's telling you the market, which is a global market, it's the Russians, it's the Chinese, it's the Indians, it's the Germans, it's all the people all around the world who manage money. They like to buy federal debt because they know and they've watched, at least over the past 9 months, that the federal government's not going to worry about a debt ceiling and go broke, and they're not going to worry about the end of their fiscal year and not pay their bills. They will keep dancing. But the problem is that becomes risky, and the people who buy bonds know that. And they say, you know, I'm sure the federal government will continue to honor its obligations, but We'd like 4.8%, please, not 2.3%. And that's what's happening. The market is telling the Federal Treasury, yeah, we'll give you more money, but we want higher interest, okay? And that's the market function, because there's not only this national income bubble of individuals and companies, but there's like a global economy. And the global economy is a lot bigger than any one government. There is no government on earth, not even Joe Biden with his F-16s and nuclear weapons, that are bigger than the global economy. The global economy was created in the beginning, and it will be here until the coming of our Lord. So it's out there. So the point is, we're starting to see fiscal reaction to federal spending. That and think about this from where that fits. You get the Federal Reserve over here, and this is quaint little banking thing they made in an island in 1913, you know, these bankers, they run around, and their big magic wand is tweak the interest rates. Should we bump them up another quarter? So they're fiddling around over here with the interest rates. Meanwhile, the global market's saying, yeah, it's great whatever the interest rates are, but if you want to borrow money from us, we want 4.8% because you guys are getting risky. And we know we'll get the money back, but we know there's going to be all this political kabuki going on, and you guys are going to run out of money, and you're going to have these fights, and you're going to kick out the speaker, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. But at the end of the day, we know one thing. The United States will pay back, but we want interest, because what you're doing is creating this global push for inflation at the same time that the Russians and the Saudis are saying, hey, we want more for our oil, because oil is worth something. Paper money and digital money is not. And that's the big difference. So we're starting to see these reactions in the marketplace. So while the Fed's over here twiddling around, and they're burning remember my three silos? You got the poor people, you got the middle class, and you got the rich people who are having a great old time making a fortune right now. The Federal Reserve is tweaking around here and hurting the poor very big, very big. They're trying to protect the poor from inflation while the federal government's creating inflation. And in the middle class, these guys are getting burned. But as the Fed tweaks the interest rates, the third silo, the wealthy silo, man, they just put their money in the bank. They're getting higher and higher interest, inflation, and properties are going up. These are great times for the rich, let me tell you. So this is the balance we have to see. And that's why when you look at these numbers that come out, you have to look at them from the perspective of this total global picture. And that's why that 30-year treasury has caught my eye, because that is a very high number. So if you're Bill Gates and you want to park your money for 30 years, you know, assuming you Mr. Health himself is going to last 30 more years, but you know, you want to park your money. 4.8% is not bad in a government bond that 30 years from now, unless something really bizarre happens, federal government's going to pay it all back. Don't worry about it, because it's just going to be deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. Meanwhile, a gallon of milk is going to cost you about $48. But you know, it all goes into balance. That's why it was, you know, another story. I know I'm getting close to the end here, but companies and households that are building themselves on debt as interest rates are going up are finding themselves cash squeezed right now for the same phenomenon. And it's harder to get loans. The interest rates are higher. And companies that were, their business model or business plan was to basically structure debt, well, that's not working really well. And I think what you're going to end up seeing is more and more companies either trying to finance away their debt, which means they need more equity to raise equity, or they're going to go into default. So anyway, sorry for all the bad news. I can only report what's going on. But thank you very much for tuning in. Look forward to talking to you tomorrow, and have a great day. Bye.